another visitor. Stay a while. Stay forever.
Ein Podcast über alte Spiele von zwei alten Männern. Stay Forever mit Gunnar Lott und Christian Schmidt.
Hello, I'm Gunnar Lott of Stay Forever. My interview partner today is Richard Leinfellner, a veteran of the British games industry. He worked for Palace Software and Mindscape and Bullfrog and Electronic Arts as a programmer, producer, and in management. Later, he ran Babel Media, a giant outsourcing provider for the games industry. Many thanks for agreeing to be on the show, Richard.
Happy to be here.
So let's talk about Shadow of the Horned Rat. The game was published in 1996. Take me back to that time. What was your job like at Mindscape? What was the world like?
Yeah, basically, I was running the software development department in the UK for a large US company called Mindscape. The whole department starts off doing conversions. So we used to take American software like Wing Commander and convert it to British systems, or we do localization. But, you know, we also started doing our own projects. And the team really wanted to work on their own projects, not just other people's work. Mm. So it really came out of the team wanting to do their own things. And originally we were working on SNES and Sega Genesis, but PC really started sort of taking off, especially as DirectX started. So we had a bunch of real Warhammer freaks working at the studio. Jeff Gaiman was a massive Warhammer player, and he ended up being the lead programmer. Really, really good guy. And there's also Steve Lenny, who was our lead artist, and he was a massive Warhammer fan. And I knew nothing about Warhammer at all. I was the sort of producer, and we just started talking about what do we want to do next. And they said, oh, we'd love to do a Warhammer game. Then I set about the logistics of actually getting a license. They're quite a protective company. I was very lucky that I met two top guys there. I mean, top, not just in terms of seniority. There's just such nice people. A guy called Andy Jones and another guy called Phil Gallagher. And Phil was in charge of licensing. And Andy was kind of the, it's hard to put it, he was kind of the go-to person for everything where he didn't know where to go to. And we went up to see them. And we pitched them. And we said, hey, we want to do this game. And that was really it.
No, it can't have been that easy.
Well, it wasn't easy because the initial reaction was, well, we've never done this. We only ever do our own stuff. You know, we're wary of video games because they saw video games as, you know, if people are playing a video game, they're not playing their game.
Yeah.
So there was a little bit of apprehension because to them, it's not just a game. To them, they refer to it as the hobby.
Mm.
It's an entire hobby. So everything from playing the game to painting the pieces, and it was just a totally holistic experience for them. So they couldn't quite see how a game that just focused on the game would fit into that. But we had quite a few meetings with them. I think we gradually put the fears to rest. One of the stipulations of the deal was we all had to spend a day at the headquarters in Nottingham, and we basically had to play their games. So everyone was going to be on the team, had to play the game, including the management, including me. They walked us through the different characters. They showed us how the models are made. So we got a really full-on becoming part of extended family type experience with them, which was really nice. You know, a lot of licensors just want to see the money, really. And they were really wanting us to do a good job, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
So it was easy because very few people approached them. But it was also difficult because the biggest difficulty was convincing the US company to do it. So actually, my biggest difficulties wasn't really Games Workshop. My biggest difficulties was the management back over in California, Novato.
Was Warhammer at that time a British thing?
Entirely. I think they had a couple of licensed outlets in the States.
Mm-hmm.
This is before the internet, so you can't just Google it.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we'd have to say, oh, there's a store in San Francisco, this place, you can go and have a look. That was it. You know, they physically had to go there. You couldn't just Google it. So a lot of persuading had to be done that this was really a thing because they were used to doing big licenses. You know? So it was seen as a quaint British thing for them.
So they were essentially humoring you.
Well, yeah, there's a degree of that because having worked for American companies pretty much my working life, there's very much a not made here syndrome. If it's not made in America, it's always seen as being second class. They think we don't understand the market. We don't understand the culture. You know, we don't understand the football. And it's the same pretty much in Japan as well. But we persevered and we got it through.
Was this part of a grander plan? So of a multiple games license, or was it just tipping the toes in the water?
I think we had the option to do a sequel. So there was always the possibility of doing a sequel.
Andy Jones, whom you already mentioned, was involved. Was he the liaison from Games Workshop?
He was largely. So I dealt with Phil on the commercial side, so the licensing agreement and the deals. And Andy was the day-to-day approvals person. We had to get everything approved by them. Every single graphic had to be approved. They gave us loads of reference. They were so good. You know, they wanted us to do a really good job. So we got loads of kits and we got all the models we needed. They were fantastic to work with. Really generous with their time, you know, especially Andy. So he played the game. He wasn't just sitting back. But for the large part, they let us get on with it, really. I think they accepted we knew what we were doing.
Mindscape and Mindscape as a developer had no experience with that type of game.
No, but one of the companies that Mindscape acquired quite early on was a company called SSI. They used to do things like Panzer General. They had an understanding of the RTS market. SSI was a wholly owned subsidiary of Mindscape. And actually what happened really is management of SSI ended up running the development of Mindscape.
So you had somebody to go to for technology or for design or for just a general feel for a strategy game?
Not really. To be honest, my methodology in those days was just not to get on the radar so we don't get cancelled. So a lot of times, you know, we showed them what we had to show and we tried to just get through the day without getting cancelled. I mean, if you're an executive in a video game company, your biggest threat is always... A lot of people think the threat is external competition. But if the company is big enough, your biggest threat is the person in the next office or the person across the water who wants your budget.
Especially when you're in a faraway land and the management is in the US.
Exactly. And it's not seen as their baby. You know, say, for example, it is very successful. They don't get credit for it. So there's a degree of that.
What was your role exactly? So you were the head of the team and the producer, but you're also credited for programming?
Yeah, so my background is programming, but turns out I was quite good at management. And the reason I was credited with programming is that I was probably the best bug fixer inside Mindscape in the UK. So when there was a nasty bug, they'd come to me and went, Richard, this keeps crashing. And then I'd sit down and figure it out. So, you know, I introduced some systems, you know, like memory management and stuff like that. You know, this is the biggest thing we've ever built. So when you build something really big, you have to think differently. It's not just a cartridge, which is, you know, 8K or 16, whatever. You know, this is a massive thing with loads of assets. So, guys, I did some of the systems that did a lot of the bug fixing. But it's also the time, actually. I sat in my office one day after just fixing a really nasty bug and feeling very good with myself. And I said to myself, I have to stop doing this. Because if I'm programming, it's just me having a reserve parachute in case I fail at producing. Because I can always go back to programming if I'm a failed producer. So that day, I actually deleted my C compiler and I stopped programming and I no longer fix bugs for people. So that's when I decided to become a business person, really.
Business person, yeah. But that's hard to let go of the skills that brought you there.
Guess what I'm doing now? I'm back to my hobby, programming, guys. So, you know, what goes around comes around. You know, it's in the blood.
How did you go about the technology? I read things about Silicon Graphics.
To be honest, everything was home built. You know, we built everything directly onto the GDI graphics subsystem. The Silicon Graphics, that was the Nintendo 64 days. You know, when they told you to program a Nintendo 64, you needed to have a Silicon Graphics machine. We spent 250K on two of them. No, one of them was 250K. And then literally within a year was propping open a door. You know, it was totally the worst money we've ever spent. But no, we didn't use those. We didn't use them for that. We just used the usual tools. I think it was Microsoft C or something.
I feel it's a strong difference if you play this game, having played Warhammer before or not. You see this in the reviews from the time where you had editors reviewing it who had never played Warhammer before and were totally confused by, what, my unit's going to run? What is this psychology thing?
Yeah, I know. The routing thing. That was actually one of the things we had major meetings over about the routing behavior. Because in the game, you have to show that actually happening. And the player's going, don't run away. Don't run away. What can I do to stop you running away? And they go, well, no, you can't do anything about that. Yeah. Don't do it. I think one of my reviews started off with, I really don't like this sort of game. And I was like, why are you reviewing it? Find somebody who does, you know, like me saying, you know, I'm going to have a cheeseburger, but I don't like cheeseburgers. You know, reviews are reviews. But we did try to make it. So the biggest conversations with Games Workshop, we wanted to make it more like a video game. And they wanted to make it more like a tabletop game.
I feel many decisions feel to have fallen on the tabletop side. I feel it's very faithful and feels very realistic because Warhammer, in a way, even if it's a tabletop game, feels realistic, but it doesn't feel that video gamey. And I feel that has hurt reception.
Well, yes. And, you know, the reality is I don't think the US company got behind it. I don't think they spent any marketing money on it. Hmm. I think we did respectably. We did well enough to commission the sequel.
Can you give a concrete example of this design process, this back and forth between video game and tabletop?
Well, one specific example comes to mind. I mean, this is kind of a weird thing. We're having this discussion, how do you go around things? Because you don't have this problem on the tabletop game, because you don't have to worry about the physical space as much. And of course, in a video game, you have to go around things, you have to follow things. So those little units have to make their own decisions, because you can't control everything. So a lot of it was really to do with how do we control this and how do you issue orders. This is probably the bit where we spent the most time thinking tabletop isn't going to work. This just isn't going to work. We need a different way of doing this. I think the navigation was a specific example, because you never have navigation in the tabletop version. And of course, when you're doing a quasi 3D game, it's all about navigation. If your units are milling around doing stupid things, it looks rubbish. They've got to move with purpose.
Why the decision to make it real-time?
Well, it's quasi-real-time. It's actually turn-based under the hood.
Yeah.
And it's purely commercial. It's that it's real-time strategy game, RTS. There was a feeling that if this wasn't real-time, it would bomb in the States.
The tabletop game is about resources in terms of points.
Yeah.
You know, I'm losing a unit, I lost 500 of my 2,000 points, whatever. But the computer game is essentially about time, because it's my time as the decision maker. I cannot give every unit the perfect orders because I'm so pressed for time, you know, switching around everything.
Yeah.
I cannot guide this unit carefully around this ravine or this pass because I have to help another fight. This makes the strongest departure from the tabletop.
Yeah, I think that was really deliberate, because at the end of the day, it is a computer game. We set out to make a fun computer game, not necessarily to make the world's most faithful Warhammer game.
It was pretty faithful for that.
It was, but we were skirting this because we wanted it to feel real time. Under the hood, it is still turn-based. It's just we hide that.
The German press called it a battle simulator, which I feel is a very fair description. Who was the target audience in your mind? Was it existing Warhammer fans?
Yeah, it was pretty much existing Warhammer fans. If you can target somebody else, then don't buy the license. The license costs money, you know. Yeah, we were targeting Warhammer fans.
But sometimes licenses provide nice background material.
Okay, here with my commercial hat on. Yes, but for the amount of money the license costs, I can employ loads of good artists.
Okay.
Yeah. The license is what we call pre-sold. What it means is you have name recognition when you go in store. I mean, obviously, the content is really good, and they had loads of content, and we used a lot of it, but the real license is really name recognition. Because otherwise, it just could become another RTS from a studio you've never heard of.
And there were many RTSs coming at that time.
Exactly. There was a lot of RTSs.
We touched this briefly when talking about the reviews. The game felt unforgiving to many of them.
Yeah, it was seen as very hard.
I feel part of it is that people were unfamiliar with the routing and the psychology and everything, but part of it is really hard.
Yeah.
The game doesn't give you much replenishing of resources.
It doesn't, and that's a common problem when you don't have enough time to test the game. The reality is when you're building a game, you never play the whole game. You play the bits you've just coded or the bits you've just worked on. So you're basically playing the game in these little chunks. And you think, oh, that little chunk is okay. That's not too difficult. The only time you can really play the whole game is at the end, which is, of course, when you have the major pressure to ship it. To be honest, if you really want a beautifully balanced game, you need to sit on it for 2 or 3 months. So, yeah, I'd say any game like that, unless you have a lot of experience, you are going to make it too hard.
Was this toned down, the difficulty, in a subsequent patch or another version?
If we did a patch, I wouldn't know how we would have done that, because there wasn't really any way of patching things. I think you probably find the community patched it.
I have something in the back of my head that was like the last battle was described as unwinnable, and I felt it pretty easy. And I feel I read something like, oh, this was because you played the other version.
Okay, it is possible, because don't forget, this is really before the internet came. If we patched it, we would have just issued new masters, and then you would have had maybe 10,000 units go out with one level, and the next 10,000 would be the next level.
How successful was the game in the end? Do you know numbers?
it wasn't a runaway hit. We had a good amount of critical acclaim. The reviews were mixed, but the good reviews were very good. And it was seen as, we've learned what we're going to do with the first one. Now let's really do the proper job on the second one, Dark Omen. So to get anything greenlit for a sequel, you have to be successful. So we definitely hit the minimum bar. Also, don't forget, Games Workshop loved it. They absolutely loved it. So at this point, suddenly, a lot of the things we were saying to make it more gamey, they were saying, yes, we agree with you. You were right.
Oh, nice. Okay, yeah.
The relationship just really grew. And then the US kind of got on board a bit. So we thought we're really going to nail it with Dark Omen.
Dark Omen, what did you have to do with the game? You went to EA Bullfrog?
No. I started Dark Omen with Mindscape.
Okay.
And I left about a year into development, about halfway through development. I was headhunted by EA. And I went to EA. When I was at EA, they had a problem with Bullfrog. So I took over running half of Bullfrog. So I took over Populous 3, for example. And at that point, EA really needed a hit. Bullfrog needed a hit because they bought the company on the premise of there's going to be a hit factory. And they hadn't shipped anything. So I was talking to Les Edgar, who was Peter's business partner. And Peter had left by then. Peter Molyneux had left by then. And we talked about, you know, how to make hits. And I said, well, what's your most successful game? And he said, well, Theme Park. I said, well, the obvious thing is to do a sequel to Theme Park. And Les said, well, that's a really good idea, Richard. A bit obvious, but nobody wants to work on this. So I said, tell what, Les, if I find a team to do that game, could I hire a team? And Les said, yeah, if you find a team to do Theme Park, yeah, absolutely, you can hire the entire team. So I went to E3, and I was walking down the corridor, and do you know a guy called Kevin Backers?
Yeah, Clem.
Kevin is a friend of mine. So I was chatting to Kevin, and I said to Kevin, God, I'd love to get my old team back because they would do this for me. You know, they would actually do this game for me. I wanted them to do Theme Park World or Theme Park sequel. So Kevin just says, go and talk to Chuck at SSI. He was now running development. So now all of the studios reported to him, and he was still at Mindscape, obviously. So I just went to the SSI booth, and I left Mindscape on good terms. So I said to Chuck, you know, don't suppose you got 10 minutes for chat? And Chuck said, yeah, I've got 10 minutes. So I sat down with him. I said, Chuck, and I literally made this up on the spot. I had no plan. I said to him, so what about Chuck? Here's a deal. You let me out of my no hire, no compete clause in my contract so I can hire my old team. So I will take the whole team from the UK to EA. I will take Dark Omen over to EA. So we'll buy Dark Omen from you and we'll cut your check next week. We'll just give you cash. I should point out, I had no authority to do this deal at all. Schnapsidee, right? Okay. So Chuck goes, that's interesting. Let's talk some more. Because I knew at that point they were thinking of closing the UK office down anyway, because they couldn't manage it. They didn't have anyone really running it. So I phoned Les. Said, hey, Les, you know, you said I could hire a whole team. He goes, yeah. I said, well, what if I just bought a game, but it comes with my entire team from Mindscape, and we get to publish the game, and we get the team that makes us Theme Park World. He goes, well, that's great. I said, okay, well, can I have $2 million, please, next week? Yeah, that's doable. So basically, I stayed over a bit longer, did a deal with SSI. Part of this would be that we would transition the whole team to EA. They would finish Dark Omen. EA would ship Dark Omen, and they would become EA employees. Or Bullfrog employees. So that's why Dark Omen ended up at EA, because I bought it.
Such a nice story.
But if it's funnier, about a year later, I got a phone call from SSI and they said, oh, you know Dark Omen? Yeah. They said, we'd like to license it back to put on a compilation because they were doing very well with his compilation packs. We'd like Dark Omen on the compilation. I said, yeah, that'll cost you $2 million. So I got my money back as well.
Oh, they paid $2 million to put Dark Omen on compilation.
Yeah, well, we got a royalty from it as well. So it was actually quite a sweet deal.
Yeah.
There you go. That's the scoop.
Oh, that's nice. Do you have any opinion on how Dark Omen turned out? To frame it from my side, I feel it's the game that Shadow of the Horned Red wanted to be.
Yeah.
And I would so have liked to see Shadow of the Horned Red with the Dark Omen engine, because I feel Shadow of the Horned Red is the more mature game in storytelling, but you know, the systems are sometimes not as well thought out or tested out as Dark Omens.
Yeah, okay, every time we do the second one, you get better. You've learned from the first one, right?
Mm.
So the team was better. The other thing is EA had really good resources. I mean, they spent a lot of money on development. You know, if we needed stuff, it was like, okay, what do you need? So we suddenly had a lot more resources, and we had a really good marketing team as well. They got behind it. So it was just really quite a different experience. You know, we thought about doing another one because we got quite good at this, but then Bullfrog had so many IPs, you know, and we're now EA Bullfrog people. So it seemed silly paying for an IP when you've got a stable of IPs you can just have for free.
Who did the main game design for both games? So who conceived this game as a series of battles of a mercenary force? That's unusual.
Yeah, I would say it's probably Jeff Gaiman and Steve Lenny. They were the real drivers behind this. You know, I totally put up my hands. I'm not a Warhammer fan. Design-wise, it was their baby.
So the main design ideas of how this game was structured and so came from the source material, essentially, by fans.
Yes, it did. They were massive, massive fans. You know, I never felt like I could tell them anything about how to make a Warhammer game. They knew far more than I ever did.
But they were not game designers. You handed game design to a programmer and an artist.
Okay, I come from a time when there were no game designers. They were just programmers. Okay. In the evolution of video games, in the beginning, there were programmers. Then along came art. Then came, I suppose, production. And production, then very late on in life came designers.
Okay.
You know, it's one of those evolution things. So, yeah. You know, to be honest, to have somebody coming with the title designer, people go, who the hell is that person? Do you know? We all design the game. There's not just one designer.
Very nice. So do you know how successful this game was?
Yeah, it did pretty well. EA was very happy with it, but I can't remember the exact numbers. And what was really amazing about this is, of course, now they knew they had a team that could deliver. And that meant I got the budget to do Theme Park World. And Theme Park World did spectacularly well.
And that worked out for you. So the team went straight with no losses, not people quitting.
No, no. I told them exactly what the plan was. I've known these people almost my entire life. I made it absolutely clear there's a real purpose to you being here. Stage one is Ship Dark Omen. Stage two is doing Theme Park.
I believe I visited the studio because I did a preview for a games magazine on Theme Park World.
Yeah, so it looked like the cooling towers in Aliens.
Yeah. That was very nice. Thank you very much. I won't take up more of your time. If you have a parting anecdote to share.
I tell you what's most amazing is people still remember these games. And that's always just amazing to me. I even talked to people who are still running Populous 3. I was playing a Populous 3 game online with people like 6 months ago. I got totally annihilated, by the way. And you think, God, this has been such a long time ago. And it's just amazing. People still love it. You know, you suddenly feel it's not just about the money. You've really touched people's lives. And that's really heartwarming, actually.
I feel people who loved Dark Omen loved it very much, very much. So like I did, I played it dozens of times. And as you told, it's still running. People are making mods for it and everything. So it's really well loved.
It is good. It is good. It is kind of a form of art, you know, and it's nice to be appreciated like that.